This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, Episode 10, was recorded on July 10th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by petroleum geologist Art Berman, author and consultant Anas Alhaji, and professional crude oil trader Tracy Shukart. Our topics this week include the Iranian situation, the nuclear threat, what's going on in markets, the EIA inventory report, which was a massive drawdown this week, as well as the storm in the Gulf of Mexico. Art Berman and Anas Alhaji will have contrasting views that so many of you have been requesting with respect to a number of issues in the market, and we'll also discuss extended maintenance season and security in the Straits of Hormuz, something that Iran has now begun to propose charging for. But first, let's dive right into the EIA inventory data. Crude oil drawing down an utterly massive 9.5 million barrels. Now, a lot of that was predicted the night before with EIA's private data report, which had predicted a slightly smaller drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, also drawing down this week, 301,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.5 million barrels. Distillates was the only build across the board at plus 3.7 million barrels. The tape action was an immediate pop up on the inventory drawdown, but initially not much follow through. In fact, we saw an immediate retracement down to a lower number below the number that was trading when the data came out. And that also happened to be back down below the 100-day moving average. At first, it looked like a pop and drop, like maybe it was going to be a sell the news event and we were going to move lower. But about an hour later, things really got going and prices really got going to the upside. Was it the inventory data, or perhaps more likely, with the developing situation with the tropical storm in the Gulf of Mexico? We'll discuss that a little bit later on in the program. Meanwhile, U.S. production ticked back up to 12.2 million barrels. So we're holding pretty steady here at just over 12 million barrels, but that rapid increase that we saw from an 11.5 all the way up to 12.4 definitely seems to have taken a pause, but it hasn't reversed quite yet. Imports were up this week to 7.3 million barrels, exports down to 3 million barrels per day, or 21 million barrels on the week. Now, let's meet this week's expert panel. Dr. Anas Alhaji is an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management, and he also taught energy economics at the University of Oklahoma and Colorado School of Mines. Anas, how important is China to the oil market, and what is the impact of recent news on increased car sales to the oil market? And heck, while we're at it, what is the impact of electric buses and vehicles in China on oil demand?
Yes, Eric. China has been the engine of global oil demand growth since 2004, when China turned to be a net importer of oil. Experts have always debated the accuracy of Chinese data, whether economic or oil demand, etc. As you all know, China does not publish oil demand data. We have to calculate the implied demand from whatever data available. And one source of the confusion about China's growth, economic growth, and growth in oil demand is the size of the black market. The size of the black market historically was huge. Now it's getting smaller, but still a very large market. And looking at 2004, for example, experts ignored the role of private generation. At that time, the Chinese government was trying to attract foreign investors, but they had major power shortages. So foreign investors asked for a guaranteed supply of electricity, and the government did guarantee that at the expense of Chinese manufacturers. And they give them, in some cases, only 2 days to open their factories and produce while they have orders for the next 3 years. So those guys resorted to private generation, which increased the demand substantially for diesel. That was not counted, and that shocked the world at that time. Then in 2005, new labor laws applied, and that kind of shut down those factories for several days a week. That led to a decline. So that led to confusion in the market. But then demand picked up again, despite the fact that China built more nuclear plants, more renewables, etc., simply because the transportation sector was expanding rapidly. Many analysts basically missed 3 points about China in recent years, and that in relation to oil demand. And the first one is the Chinese started moving from small cars to SUVs and crossovers, which is very common in China's streets right now. They ignore the fact that China is stockpiling strategic petroleum reserves. And the reason why, because they are looking at the next 100 years. And for them, the probability of closure of Malacca Strait by the United States or others is a real possibility in the next few decades. So they want to guarantee that they have enough oil for 6 months or 9 months. So they've been storing oil, and they are going to continue to store oil regardless of the oil price. However, they are opportunistic, and they try to buy when there is a downturn in prices. The third point that we missed is regarding what you ask about the electric buses and the electric cars. One of the problems in the numbers available right now, if you Google it or you look at the stories in the news, that, oh, we have this number of cars and this number of e-buses, and they replace this much of oil demand. This is absolutely nonsense. Here is why. The first one is, most of those buses were running on CNG, compressed natural gas. So it was natural gas that lost. It wasn't oil. The second one is, for especially fancy cars like Tesla, only the rich Chinese can afford it, and most likely it is the second or the third or the fourth car, and it's used on occasion just to show off. So this boom that people are talking about in China in electric vehicles and electric buses is not really affecting oil demand as much as they are saying. So the bottom line here is China is still very important to oil demand. Stockpiling will continue. The impact of EVs and e-buses is limited. And at the same time, those renewables are limited too. And the reason why they are limited, because solar panels, especially the Chinese solar panels, cannot operate at full capacity with complete efficiency when the weather is very hot and humid. Temperatures in the summer, especially in eastern China, is very high, and humidity in some cases is close to 100%. So there is less efficiency in this case, despite the increase in renewables. So that's a summary of my views on China.
Anas, thanks so much for that. Art Berman is a petroleum geologist who spends most of his time drilling oil wells, but he's also become a favorite keynote speaker and consultant to investors. Art put together a slide deck for today's episode, and you can download it from our homepage at macrovoices.com. Art, yesterday, the EIA published its short-term energy outlook report. Please give our listeners a summary of the key takeaways that you found in that report.
Sure, Eric. There's a lot in there. I'm still absorbing it. But for those who want to follow along in my slide deck, we're looking at slides 2 through 9. I'm not going to refer to all of them as I speak, but just know they're there. I guess the headline item is that U.S. oil production has magically climbed above 12 million barrels a day of crude and condensate. I'm not really sure why the news sources picked up on that, because in fact that record was reached in the previous month, but news will be news. Where we're at right now is U.S. production fell very slightly in June compared to May, but the forecast, EIA's forecast, is that U.S. output will increase another 750,000 barrels by the end of the year, almost to 13 million barrels per day. So that is basically carrying a very large percentage of world supply growth, which I'll mention again towards the end of this discussion. Year over year, however, and this should surprise no one, the growth of U.S. output is slowing. So in June, we slowed to 1.5 million barrels per day from May, which was 1.7. So basically, output growth has been decreasing since its peak back in the summer around August of 2018. Now, the world production picture in some ways mirrors the U.S., but it is really interesting to note that world production peaked in October of 2018, declined substantially with oil prices and the price collapse last year, down to March, and now it's climbing back up again. Surprise, surprise. So basically, world production increased almost a million barrels a day, 0.97. in the month of June compared to the month of May, and it's now at 101.3. So that's a really, really big single-month increase, if we believe it. I think more importantly than the specifics of this month or that month is what's happened trend-wise. And trend-wise, world production has grown 1.77 million barrels a day over the last 3 months. So things are running along at full speed as far as the world goes. And unlike the U.S., the year-over-year picture continues to grow. So we're growing at about a million barrels per day in June, and that's up from the low in March. So again, not a surprise, but noteworthy. The really important piece of information, though, here is that world output fell by 2.8 million barrels a day from October to March, and has increased 1.8 from March to June. So the world has effectively moving very rapidly back towards the oversupply that put us into the oil price collapse late last year. Looking at the international picture, the winners and losers should surprise no one. The biggest increase year-to-date, 2019, compared to last year, is the U.S. U.S. has increased over a million barrels per day. We're talking here about crude and condensate. The other big winners, if you can call them that, UAE, Iraq, Libya, China, and Russia, much smaller numbers than the U.S. UAE was 182,000 barrels a day, Iraq, 153. The big losers also should surprise no one. Iran tops the list or bottoms the list, depending on how you want to put it, of losers, minus 1.2 million a day. Venezuela, again, what a surprise, minus a little more than 500,000 barrels a day. Saudi Arabia down 400,000 barrels a day, self-enforced. Brazil down 228, Mexico down a little bit more than 100. So the summary of what's happening leads then to, and for those who want to take a look at this slide, it's number 7 in my deck, looking at the combined IEA demand forecast with EIA production numbers for the two quarters that IEA doesn't forecast. What we're looking at here is essentially very near balance for world supply demand in both the second and the third quarters of 2019, very slightly overbalanced in the second quarter, slightly underbalanced in the third quarter, and then jumps up to about a 700,000 barrel per day surplus in the fourth quarter. Interestingly, Brent price just kind of stays flat through this. Again, this is a forecast, which a lot of people won't believe, but you know that is the kind of the mark-to-market situation. And then finally, looking at slide 8, I've sort of averaged all those quarters into trends so we can see what's basically going on trend-wise. And even those who don't like forecasts, I think this is pretty useful. And what it shows is that right now we're essentially in balance. And from the fourth quarter of this year through the end of next year, we'll be at a very slight, about 150,000 barrel a day surplus. So that's what the EIA short-term energy outlook has to say. And basically, nothing radical, but the world continues to move towards higher production led by the United States.
Well, thanks for that, Art. And again, listeners, you can find the download link for Art's slide deck on our homepage at macrovoices.com in the body of the write-up describing today's episode. Let's move on to our final panelist. Tracy Schuchart is a professional crude oil trader who worked on the floor of the exchange in Chicago before moving on to become a full-time futures trader. Tracy, what do you make of the news about Iran threatening to scale up uranium enrichment? Are they actually gearing up their nuclear weapons capability for a war, or do you think this is just a negotiating tactic?
I don't believe that Iran is actually trying to build it, but rather use this as a tactic for sanctions relief. First, Iran cannot turn its low enriched uranium into weapons grade material without going through very detectable steps. It would need to produce 4 to 5 times more to have enough material for a single weapon. It'd have to reconstitute the centrifuges and increase the percentage to make the rare uranium-235 isotope that is needed to make these weapons. Tehran has already dismantled 2/3 of these machines under the JCPOA deal. It'd have to rearrange them, and it'd have to spin them for several months. And all of this activity could be spotted by IAEA, that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, and UN inspections team, even if they try to do it covertly. And so far, none of this has happened. Two, they use this very same tactic after the 2012 sanctions before the JCPOA deal, and it worked. So why not try again? In 2013, in May, they announced that they were moving ahead with their nuclear program, and they were going to up enrichment to 5%. By November of that year, Iran, U.S., France, Germany, Britain, China, and Russia all nailed down an accord in Geneva that basically laid the groundwork for what was to become JCPOA deal in 2015. Just this morning, you know, we've heard several announcements. Just this morning, Iran's ambassador told IAEA that his country wants to stick to the nuclear deal, but only if all parties fulfill commitments. So they've been sending these messages, we're going to, you know, up our uranium enrichments. But at the same time, they keep saying that they want to talk. So I think this latest announcement of Iran's violation should be seen kind of for what it is, and that's a calibrated response to compel the remaining deal signatories to counter the U.S. maximum pressure through sanctions campaign.
Well, thanks for that, Tracy. We'll be back with our full panel for our first discussion topic right after this. For our first discussion topic, I want to get to what's going on in the market, why we saw such a big breakout today. Was it just the big unexpected drawdown on inventory, or was there more to it than that? But first, during our break, Anas had a couple of reactions, wanted to react to some of the things that Tracy said. Anas, give us your perspective on Iran before we come back to EIA and the market reaction.
Well, the issue here is it doesn't matter whether Iran is developing a nuclear bomb or if it is for peaceful power plants. The whole idea here is, if you really look at it, that any nuclear in Iran that would bring more electricity to the people of Iran, it means stability of the regime. And from the U.S. point of view, stability of the regime is a threat to U.S. national security and threat to the national security of the other Gulf nations that are allies to the United States. So whether it's a peaceful program or not, it doesn't matter. The U.S. will oppose that because it leads to the stability of the regime. And for the regime, it understands that most of the population is young. Most of the culture basically changed from the old days. The demand for electricity is skyrocketing, and they need to provide that electricity. They don't have enough resources to generate that electricity. If they do, then their exports, even under normal circumstances, of natural gas and oil is going to decline. So for them, they see nuclear as stability for the regime, and the United States does not want that. So whether it's a nuclear bomb or the issue here, it doesn't matter. They are going to be viewed as stabilizing the regime.
Fantastic. Thanks, Hannes. Let's move on to this market, because what we saw this morning was a EIA report that just blew everybody away with 9.5 million barrels of drawdown on crude oil inventories. Now, there was obviously a pop up in prices, but frankly, that pop up in prices fully retraced and the price moved back down below the 100-day moving average. It really looked at first like a pop and drop, like maybe it was a sell the news event and we were going to trade lower. But then about an hour later, the market really started to take off and moved close to a dollar higher after that. What's going on here? Is this just the market being slow to react to EIA, or is this weather related? What else is going on that's driving the market, and what should we make of it?
Well, Eric, well, first we saw a pop last night in inventories after API, and that news kind of faded fast. I think people are kind of used to kind of fading that move, even though that we kind of had that initial shock. But what happened overnight is we had this tropical storm in the Gulf of Mexico, and we had 15 platform evacuations. So the market then started to ramp up overnight when that news came out. I think that was around midnight. And then, you know, once inventories hit, was even bigger than API, and we just haven't stopped. We also found out just towards the end of the day that 18% of natural gas is sidelined right now in the Gulf of Mexico, not the whole country. And 32% of production, around 600,000 barrels, is sidelined right now in the Gulf of Mexico because of that. So I think all of that, you know, it was kind of like the perfect storm for oil today.
So we've got the combination of a tropical storm in the Gulf and this massive drawdown. I want to go to Art Berman next on the massive drawdown, because something really caught my attention here, Art. When I heard 9.5 million barrel drawdown, I thought to myself, okay, I'm sure I know what's going on immediately. What we're going to see is that probably if there's a big drawdown, it means imports are down this week, exports are up, and it all has to do with foreign shipments. It's probably not internal consumption. But actually, it's almost like the reverse is true. Imports were up this week and exports were down. Yet we still saw this 9.5 million barrel drawdown. And we also saw a Cushing, Oklahoma drawdown. The last couple of national drawdowns were actually Cushing builds. This week was a Cushing drawdown. So what does this whole picture spell for you in terms of comparative inventory, Art?
Right, Eric. And so I know the market is really, you know, gaga over this big crude oil drawdown. But frankly, to me, it's, you know, it's worth noting. But when I look at the whole picture, when I look at crude plus refined products, it's not that big of a move. Comparative inventory that I look at moved down about 4.7 million barrels, which is, as I said, I mean, it's not nothing. It's definitely something, but it's not this gigantic breakout that everybody seems to think. So crude oil made the biggest move, clearly, and gasoline made a move down, distillate made a move up. But my sense of what this is saying is, first of all, we're right on the comparative inventory yield curve. So the weekly price of $57.50 about was absolutely correct. So our current price of $60 and change is something like $2.50 or $3 overvalued based on the comparative inventory yield curve, which, by the way, has been pretty darn accurate. So, you know, first reaction, to me, it's worth paying attention to. It's not worth bidding oil up $3, but markets work as markets work. But what really made the difference this week, in my view, other than what Tracy already mentioned with, you know, a closing of a number of offshore platforms, was unaccounted for oil. Unaccounted for oil has gone up consistently every week for the last two, almost 3 months. And for the first time in a long time, it went down. Now, I know that some people think that unaccounted for oil doesn't matter, that somehow it gets, it goes out with the wash in the monthly data. That's not really true. There's a fairly large adjustment factor in the monthly data, but all they do is they just allocate what is now unaccounted for oil into inventory. So again, my view of unaccounted for oil is that it's real and it's substantial and it's not a fudge factor. It's actually, in my view, it's inventory that's held on leases that's dumped on the market. And so since the EIA doesn't monitor lease inventory anymore, it's unaccounted for by, you know, just by sensu stricto definition. And so unaccounted oil has been adding a lot to inventories. And this week, it went down quite a bit. It went down, you know, 3.5 million barrels. So to me, that's what's different this week. So again, it's not an accounting problem. It's the fact that for some reason, less lease oil was dumped out on the market, and that allowed the natural progression, so-called natural, of the inputs and outputs from production, net imports, and refinery intakes to do their thing. And refinery intakes were up. Your final utilization reached the highest level since the maintenance period happened and reached a bottom in February, March. So to me, it's a rational move in the market. And if we continue to see a reduction in unaccounted for oil, then I think this is the direction we're going. I hesitate to predict that, but that's my take on it.
Thanks for that, Art. Honest, give us your reactions to both what Tracy and Art just said.
Generally speaking, the decline in storage was expected, and I wrote about this on my Twitter account last week. My number was about 7.5. There was some adjustment in the numbers, so it's almost kind of where it's supposed to be. But we have to remember that I seriously think that the increase in oil prices today is mostly related to the storage, and here is why. Because any storm in the Gulf of Mexico today is going to curtail U.S. exports. And as you all know, U.S. export basically played a big role in inventories. If we cannot export, that means oil inventories will go up next week or the following week. So it's not only about the loss of production. It is also on the other side on exports, whether we can export or not. And this is, I think, a big, big problem. The other issue is, while I agree with Art on the importance of the adjustment, I think I disagree with him on what is the source. I think, generally speaking, oil analysts do not agree on what is the source of adjustment and where this comes from. The IEA say something, and every analyst I know is saying something else different. And in my view, it is really production related, that production basically is overestimated. And that's why we've seen this major adjustment in production that is almost equivalent to the adjustment that is mentioned in the report. So we agree on the importance of it, but we don't agree on the source. But again, all analysts do not agree on this point.
Let me jump in there then and say, I don't think we disagree, Anas. The logic behind what I'm saying is that unaccounted for oil is produced oil. It just doesn't go to sales at the time that it's produced. So it's counted as production when it's produced. And the reason I am very confident in this is that the state regulatory agencies, have got to get their pound of flesh. The only reason they care, basically, about oil production is so they can get their taxes. And so the idea that somehow the production numbers are way wrong, especially underestimated, says that, well, that means the states are stupid and they're not getting their tax payments. So it's my belief that the production, when it's reported, is real. The fact that it doesn't go to sales and sits on the lease or somewhere else, you know, the so-called dark inventory that Chris Cook talks about, doesn't invalidate any of the numbers. It's just it's a holding pattern before it gets put out on the market. But I want to respond too to Eric's comment about the importance of exports and imports to the entire inventory situation. So if you go and take a look at my slide number 15, here I'm showing a combination of net crude imports, crude exports, and this unaccounted for oil, including Strategic Petroleum Reserve withdrawals. And what you see is a very anomalous decrease in net crude imports that took place between the end of January and the end of February. So net crude imports decreased 1.8 million barrels per day. I mean, that is huge. Extraordinary is the word that I used on the slide. Crude exports increased 0.8 million, almost a million barrels a day during that same period. So it's basically this combination, along with, notice that the unaccounted for oil in gray on slide 15, it flattened out. So it had been growing for, you know, since the summer of 18. It grew and grew and grew again, beginning in March through basically this last week, and it flattened out for a period of about a month. So the combination of higher exports, which resulted largely in net crude import reduction, plus the fact that the unaccounted for oil went to null, resulted in the big change in inventory. Now, the other really important thing is to look at the slide number 14 right before it. And here I've done something I have to admit, probably everybody's thankful I don't do it more often, but I was interested enough in this that I actually did a crude oil, a comparative net crude import. So I'm just comparing net imports of crude oil to their five-year average. So that's the red curve. And then the ordinary crude oil comparative inventory, this is not with products, just crude, is shown in green. And so what we see is that this anomalous decrease in U.S. stocks shown in green coincides perfectly with the reduction in net crude imports compared to its five-year average. And when they started rising again, when comparative inventory, when stocks started building March through June, guess what? The net crude imports compared to the five-year average also started increasing. We've seen drawdowns since the first week in June, and voila, we see that comparative net crude imports have been dropping. So to me, this is the key. This is what, through all the noise of the many other factors that we talk about, this is what's actually controlling U.S. stock levels. It's not just about exports. It's about the net crude imports. And eventually, where we might get in this conversation is that I believe that one of the things that happened during the recent extended maintenance, refinery maintenance, was that these refineries were re-engineered to take more light sweet crude oil from the United States. And what we see is a marked increase in refinery efficiency since the middle of March. And so we're seeing less crude intakes than normal, and everybody's saying, oh, well, that's anomalous. But when we actually look at the product supplied, it's greater. So we're producing more product with less crude intakes, and there's only a couple of ways to do this. I'm not a refinery person, but we've got some, you know, some colleagues on Twitter, Big Oren, among others, who've helped me through this. And the only way to do that is to change the composition. You got to get rid of heavy stuff and convert it to light stuff. And the best way to do that is you just start bringing in more light sweet crude oil, which, by the way, is the best bargain for U.S. refiners, so it makes perfect sense.
I am sorry, Art, you got it all wrong on both fronts. First of all, on the production data and the taxes, notice that the EIA does not trust the state of Texas and does not trust the Texas Railroad Commission, where the data comes from, and therefore they create their own model to estimate the Texas production, which is way, way higher than what the Texas Railroad Commission is reporting and what Drilling Info is reporting. So it's not about being stupid or not. It is really about the data basically is not coming in timely fashion. In fact, for the state of Texas to get the true data, they need to wait for 2 years. So the reason why the EIA data that you are using in the chart does not match the state data is probably that overestimation by the equations. Regarding the efficiency of the refineries, I am sorry to say that the whole chart basically is wrong. Here is why. If you look at the definition of product supplied, and I'll be happy to post those slides and the definition. I'm going to read part of it here. This is the definition of products supplied. It includes product imports. And product imports in 2019 is higher than 18, specifically in recent months because of the refinery outages. So you have to count for the imports of products in this case to make that conclusion. There was no efficiency in this case. It just simple imports of products that's been lump sum with products supplied. So that's not the right way of making the comparison to conclude that there was efficiency. The fact is, if you do the right chart, which I'm going to post, you will see a negative correlation between refinery utilization and crude oil stocks. I mean, it's just like an amazing negative correlation between them. So the idea that the refinery utilization is still a major issue for oil stocks, it's still there because the data shows up there. And for the efficiency, no, we don't have that efficiency that is improved the outcome of those refineries. And because the difference in data between the state of Texas and the EIA, the possibility of a big revision coming up later at the end of the year is very high. So yes, we both agree on the adjustment factor that's going up. We disagree on the reasons, but to say that states have the right data, the right timely data because of taxation, this is absolutely not the case.
Well, fair enough. I don't want to debate the details of that. I have more faith in the production data than you do, but I think the bigger issue here on us is the way EIA breaks out product supplied. That is product supplied for the domestic market. Yes, it includes, I mean, imported oil obviously goes into the refinery. But if you look at the way that they report it, and the STIO is you know, it's perfectly clear that products that get exported are accounted for separately. So, you know, I don't want to get into the details of this in this discussion, but let's just say we disagree. The way I'm doing it, I think that the domestic products supplied, in other words, and EIA says it, they say that products supplied is a proxy for U.S. consumption. I don't know that I fully agree with that, but that's why. They say that because they've adjusted it so that it's product supplied to the domestic market. But anyway, I find your comments very interesting, and I'll look forward to seeing your slides. I'm not saying I'm right, but I'm saying that this is the way that the direction that the data leads me. The fact that you see it completely differently is part of what makes these panel discussions fun.
And our listeners have asked us for contrasting views, and we at Macro Voices never stop delivering. So I think we've pretty much hit that subject with Art and Anas's contrasting viewpoints. Let's move on to another subject, which I think is very important. Iran has proposed, as I understand it, to begin charging for security in the Straits of Hormuz. Now, this sounds a little bit to me like a mafia protection racket. I'm not quite sure what to make of it. But I think there's also a bigger question, which is, frankly, the overall geopolitical tension situation as it pertains to the oil market. Has it gotten better or worse since a few weeks ago when we had the tanker attacks? I mean, on the one hand, it seems like we haven't had any more, torpedo attacks or bomb attacks on tankers, but at the same time, we have had a lot of other things that have been developing. So let's go and get the whole panel's perspective, both on the geopolitics generally, and particularly this proposal from Iran. Anas, why don't you kick things off?
Generally speaking, we are getting some really conflicting signals that are very strange signals. Some of the information that's been given to us was wrong. For example, if you look at a country like the UAE, they are not accusing Iran anymore, while Saudi Arabia continued to accuse Iran. On the other hand, that Norwegian tanker, that it's a Panamanian tanker, I think, but it's Norwegian-owned, could be wrong with that. It is a Norwegian tanker that's been hit in Fujairah in May. And supposedly it was carrying oil, and it was a European tanker from a country that is part of NATO. And then we ended up with a situation now where that tanker right now is in Iran. It's being repaired in Dubai, and it is back in Iran being oil to deliver it to Iran. And we discovered now that it is vegetable oil. So this information was not available before. No one said it was going to Iran, and no one said it was vegetable oil. They said just it's oil, and it is in UAE. So this is very confusing.
Tracy Shuchart, let's get your perspective next on this whole situation. Protection in the Straits of Hormuz. Before you know it, I'm sure our brokers will be charging us for that as well.
Just wanted to add, talk a little bit about the background. The regime of passage was one of the key issues in negotiations of the 1982 United Nations Convention for Law of the Sea, which is UNCLOS. And the question of can you block or charge for the right of passage provides a really interesting legal situation, because on one hand, Iran has signed but not ratified UNCLOS. But it has ratified the 1958 Geneva Convention on Territorial Sea and Continuous Zone. On the other hand, Oman, the other coastal state, has ratified UNCLOS, but not the 1958 Geneva Convention. And the United States has not signed UNCLOS, but considers it to reflect customary international law. So we have these international laws right now that are kind of coexisting, but not necessarily meshing. So it does provide an interesting legal question. I mean, I think that, again, what Anna said, that most of the coast, the waterways are through the UAE side, the Omani side. So, I don't know, maybe that shipping lane gets really crowded if Iran decides to start charging. But again, I think there is a question of legality there, whether you can actually do this by international law.
Listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town, and we do intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in these markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll also gain access to our Thursday night podcast, which has a much more general macroeconomic focus. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our Macro Voices content free to the listener. To save time here on the podcast, I've prepared a detailed video explaining the sponsorship opportunities. You can find that at macrovoices.com/sponsorinfo. Before we close, I want to ask each of our panelists what they'll be watching for in energy markets in the coming week. Tracy Shuchart, what will you be looking for in the week ahead?
Well, I obviously will be looking, how long is the storm going to last, and, what amount of production, imports and exports are going to be affected in the Gulf. And obviously, we're looking very forward to inventory numbers again next week. And I'm keeping my eyes peeled, obviously, for the international incidents. But again, really, this storm is really what I'll be watching most about.
And Dr. Anas Al-Haji, what will you be looking for in the week ahead?
I think just like everyone else, I'm going to look at the impact of the storm, since U.S. exports are something relatively new. We are trying to assess kind of a trend over time, how storms in the Gulf of Mexico and their locations basically affect exports, so we can learn the impact of future storms. The second point basically is, I, of course, inventories, and I think we are going to have another big draw next week, and we'll see what will be the impact on oil prices.
Art Berman, what are you going to be looking for in the week ahead?
Eric, I'm going to be looking particularly at this issue that we've discussed here today, which has to do with where are net imports and exports going. We've seen the big crude withdrawal. Anas has suggested that, perhaps everything's going to change now that we're going to be offline in the Gulf of Mexico for, some period of time. So I'm always looking at inventories. I think one of the things that's come out of this discussion today is what many of us have already known, but that inventories have a lot to do with the composition of our total net imports, both refined products and crude oil. So those are the things I'll be looking at hardest.
Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. For next week's panel, we have Anas Al-Haji returning, as well as Pat Hemsworth and Joe McMonagle. But before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Let's start with the infamous Shy Girl, Tracy Shuchart.
My website is shygirl.com, and my Twitter handle, of course, is at shygirl, C-H-I-G-R-L.
And again, that spelling is C-H-I, like Chicago, G-R-L, like girl. Dr. Anas Alhaji, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work.
My website, which is my first name and last name, anasalhaji.com, and my Twitter, which is at anasalhaji.com.
And Art Berman, please tell our listeners what they can expect to find at artberman.com and also your Twitter handle.
Artberman.com has just about everything that goes on that I do, including this podcast, not to be redundant with Macro Voices, but you can find it there too. It just leads you right back to Macro Voices. And then my Twitter account at AEBerman12 is where I basically spew out everything that comes into my mind, some of which Anas has shot down today or tried to. But if you want to see it unexpurgated, go to AEBerman12. That's where you'll find it.
Fantastic. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. We'll see you next week, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.